Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our third judge, Judge Rovner, is not able to be here, unfortunately. But she will listen to the tapes of the argument and participate in the decision. And if she has questions after listening to tapes, you know, we might have to ask you for further propound questions or have further argument. But we hope that won't be necessary. So, in any event, first case for argument is Springman versus AIG Marketing. Mr. Piper.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. May it please the Court. This Court has fashioned a state law relation back test to decide when changes in pending state cases trigger jurisdiction for removal under the Class Action Fairness Act. And the issues today are, does that state law relation back test apply when the change is adding a new defendant to correct a case of mistaken identity? And if so, how does that apply to the facts of this case? And our position is that the amendment did relate back because the new defendant was fully aware of the case of the mistaken identity and was not in any way prejudiced by the amendment. Now, I'd like to...
Why did it take so many years to join them?
Well, Your Honor, there are several reasons for that. One is that there was another class action pending which told the statute of limitations.
That's not an answer.
Two, the record was unclear as to what the situation was. There were documents that were provided to Mr. Springman that did identify AIG Claim Services as the company that was responsible for the adjustments.
Yeah, people sue everyone in sight, right? I don't understand why you didn't.
Well, Your Honor, those are the reasons that the record shows for why it took some time.
That doesn't make any sense. Now, look, is it your position that you can hang around for 20 years and then pull someone into a case?
Not if there's going to be prejudice to that new defendant, but here that's not the case. For example, the lawyers who are presently representing AIG Marketing are the lawyers that were representing the case from the beginning. But not only are the lawyers the same, but the corporate employee who was defending the case for AIG Claim Services was actually an employee of AIG.
Suppose you sue X, and Y is there, and Y says, why are they suing X? Why aren't they suing me? I'm the one they... who did what they think is wrongful. Now, what is Y supposed to do? Supposed to write the plaintiff and say, sue me? Supposed to intervene and say, oh, you know, I really should be the defendant here. I want to be the defendant. What is he supposed to do?
Well, I suppose one thing AIG Claim Services could have done would have been to file a motion for summary judgment presenting evidence on this issue, which they did not do.
Why would someone who has not been named as a defendant want to precipitate himself into the lawsuit?
Well, but that goes to the point that they knew exactly what was going on.
Sure, but they don't know why you haven't decided to sue them. Now, what are they supposed to do?
Well,
why don't you get off the dime and sue them? I don't get it. Years pass, don't sue them.
Your Honor, that point goes to two questions. The first is it goes to whether the amendment should have been allowed in the first place, and that was the argument that they made in the state court, was that this amendment should not be allowed.
One of the questionable features of this body of law is, I mean, I realize we've said this, that state law governs these relation back issues. Why? I mean, if Congress wanted to provide, you know, this federal forum for these class actions, why would it want a state judge to be able to screw up everything, right, with granting peculiar amendments, relation back, right? The state judge can say, oh, we can beat CAFA here. I'll just say relation back.
Well, the judge didn't do that in this case, for one thing. We asked her to do that, and she refused to do it. She said she'd need to read the case law in relation back. Your Honor, if you wanted a bright line rule, the court could have taken commence to mean when the case was first filed and given a case number. The reason that the court...
Another bright line rule is if you add a defendant, that defendant can remove, of course.
Well, that would also be a bright line rule, but it would be inconsistent with the relation back test and the reasons that the court expanded the effective date.
No, there's a difference between a claim and a defendant because, look, you file a suit with a claim and so on, but the claims evolve over the course of the suit. They're not set in stone by the filing of the complaint. But a defendant, that's a big deal. You add a defendant. So, and that's a new person, and he has his rights. So why can't he remove?
Your Honor, in general, I think Schillinger's right that a defendant could remove, the reason being that normally the new defendant doesn't know about the case.
But this business about not knowing bothers me because, as I say, I know I'm Y in my example. I know I could be sued by this guy, but he hasn't sued me. So what am I supposed to do? I'm in a limbo. I'm not going to precipitate a suit against me. I don't know why he isn't suing. Years passed. I don't know what's going on. Finally, I'm sued.
Well, of course, that happens all the time. That's why we have
all the time.
Well, and that's why we have statutes of limitation in the first place, to give some repose.
Yeah, but you don't have repose here because your notion of relation back is, there's no prejudice. Well, it can be 20 years later you relate back. You beat the statute of limitations.
Well, the thing I think that Your Honor's questions are missing is that here there would have been no strategic reason.
There doesn't seem to be any reason at all.
Right. So the...
Well, if there isn't any reason at all, that seems to me to put you in a very bad position. Because you don't have any... You're asking for this special benefit, getting back into Madison County, but you don't have any reason why you let the, not join...
Well, Your Honor, why would it be a special benefit? Why is it a special benefit that a law is passed which applies only to new cases, and a case that was filed before the law was passed? I think it's a special benefit.
Well, it's a new case as far as AIGM is concerned.
Well, that's the question, but that is the question. I mean, why was the effective date of CAFA expand it to give a special benefit to defendants? It's the defendants that get a special benefit by being able to apply CAFA to a case that was pre-existing. It's not the plaintiffs that are asking for any kind of special benefit here.
Let me get on a different topic for a moment.
Sure.
You happen to pick, of all places, Madison County to file this lawsuit, and it's pretty apparent that the Federal Class Action Fairness Act was in response to these perceived abuses in places, particularly Madison County. So if that is true, why wouldn't we, as a federal court, want to fulfill the purpose of Congress to move these cases into federal court? Why wouldn't we want to construe particularly a relation back doctrine as to adding a new party in favor of a federal forum as opposed to sending it back to state court?
Well, basically for the reason that Your Honor wrote in, I believe, the Schorsch decision, I forget which case it was, but for the reason that Congress struck a balance in the effective date to make it not be retroactive. So, and by one definition, commenced would mean when a case is started and assigned a case number. You wanted to expand that to protect defendants from craftiness of plaintiffs' lawyers, as Judge Easterbrook put it, tending a garden of cases where they would suddenly bring in a totally unrelated case to try to evade CAFA. That's clearly not what happened here. This is not about craftiness, about sneaking in a new lawsuit where none existed. What happened here was a case was plodding along. There was a forum non-motion.
How did you happen to select Madison County as the state court that you would file this action?
Well, that's where our law firm is headquartered, and the plaintiff lived just across the border in the next county. We file most of our cases down there. That's where most of our plaintiffs live. The case was filed there. It was pending. And the evidence is entirely clear here that AIG Marketing was the company defending the case. I mean, there is absolutely no question that marketing was the one that had the witness who was answering the discovery. They were...
So when did they have a witness who answered the discovery? When was that?
Well, she testified in her deposition that she saw
when,
the...
When did she testify?
Her testimony was given last summer. She first saw the complaint within a month or two after it was filed. She filed an affidavit a few months later. She verified discovery responses. She was the person that was defending the case for AIG throughout the time from when the case was first filed.
Did they answer some interrogatories indicating that that was the wrong?
Right. Well, and that's the point that Judge Posner is hitting me on, is that there were interrogatory answers filed late in 2004, which indicated that AIG Marketing was the company that had adjusted the claim, not the defendant that had been sued. But
so you knew you were you'd sued the wrong defendant, but you didn't do anything.
Well, nothing was done other than to litigate the forum non.
You had sued the wrong defendant.
I think.
What happens when you discover you've sued the wrong defendant? You just let the suit drag on. Maybe you get some money from that defendant.
Well, there's no indication here that there was some nefarious purpose. They
well,
have
I'm
not
wondering
suggested
if there wasn't a nefarious purpose, because why didn't you drop the suit as soon as you discovered you had the wrong defendant?
What was happening was there was another suit progressing at a faster pace.
Get the other suit. When you discovered that this you had the wrong defendant in this suit, why didn't you drop this defendant?
You know, Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that question.
That's a very bad non-answer, because it seems to me very improper to persist in a lawsuit after you've discovered that you sued the wrong person.
Well, the reason I don't know is that I was not involved in the
case.
That's
no answer, because it's your responsibility as the lawyer to find out what the facts are.
Well, what I'm saying is I wasn't the one handling at that point.
I don't care who was handling at that point.
Let me address your question.
You discovered that you had sued the wrong defendant, and years pass before you dropped that defendant.
Well, as I've stated, though, the record was somewhat murky on that point.
Somewhat murky. Why didn't, if once you discover you may have the wrong defendant, you have a duty to find out if you have the wrong defendant. It's extremely wrongful to keep a person as a defendant in a lawsuit when you have strong reason to doubt it's the wrong defendant. Not that, you know, may not be guilty, but the wrong defendant.
Well, Your Honor, the record here shows that the record was murky as to the roles of these parties. AIG's
so if it's murky, why didn't you try to clarify it? Now, you gave the real answer. Yeah, another suit pending. Who cares? You know.
Well, in that case, told the statute of limitations, so there was
yes,
no
yes, but that's no excuse. That's no excuse. Look, tolling the statute of limitations like saying, well, fine, now I don't have to worry. Since I've told the statute of limitations, I don't have to worry whether I have the right defendant. I'll add him later. Meanwhile, I have the wrong defendant, but I'll keep after him, right?
Your Honor, should I take my rebuttal time? I'll step aside and let
Mr. Hockman.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Rob Hockman on behalf of Appalese, INIC, and AIGM. I'll be brief, Your Honors. I seem to have a fairly firm grasp of the case. And I'll just start with the suggestion that the record was murky, which I think just simply doesn't hold up.
Well, how many different? These two defendants are pretty similar. They're cousins, I would assume, right?
Well, they're corporate affiliates, but they have separate corporate.
And the names are very, very similar.
Right, that's true.
So, I mean, how does that, maybe a lawyer has to know this stuff, but how does somebody else ever figure out which is the right defendant?
Well, but the plaintiff, of course, did have a lawyer looking over these materials, and all the corporate formalities were observed, and there's no suggestion.
And this is not a case like you're suing Pepsi and you're supposed to sue Coke or something. These two, these two defendants look pretty much identical to me.
Well, they do different functions within the AIG family of companies, and they are, as many companies are structured, separately incorporated, and all the corporate formalities are observed, and they are treated as separate legal entities, and lawyers who are conducting the case ought to know that, and this wouldn't be the first time that a failure to sue the right party had consequences.
How many different entities are there under this umbrella?
I'm not familiar, and the record doesn't show the entire AIG family structure. But as I understand it, there are basically, in the auto business, there are two divisions of AIG into which the family of underwriting companies fall. Then, in addition to the underwriting companies, and INIC is an underwriting company, there are the claims handling companies. That's what AIGCS was, and AIGCS no longer exists. It's been changed into a different entity. And what AIGM does as well. And with respect to auto policies at this time, I believe that AIGM is the only claims handling company with respect to auto policies. The problem isn't that there was an overabundance of companies handling these auto policies, it's that there were different time frames over which they were handling these claims. So AIGCS...
Yeah, well, this named defendant actually did some of this work earlier, but not the work, not the claims handling here.
That's exactly right.
It's pretty hard to keep track of all that stuff.
Well, it doesn't look like plaintiff's counsel had that much difficulty keeping track, because in the Morningstar case, the other case that we refer to, they actually aligned proper plaintiffs with the proper claims handling companies, and they named both AIGCS and AIGM in that suit by December 2004. And at that point in time, we had already told them in this case, they had already been told not only that AIGCS was the wrong claims handling company, but also that by then AIGM was the proper claims handling company. We told them that a month before. And as they themselves admit in their brief, it didn't take an awfully long time for them to modify this complaint. All they did was swap out the letters AIGCS for AIGM.
Now, so you're saying December 2004 was when they discovered that they had the wrong company?
Well, it's no later than November 2004. That's when we told them.
So when did they amend the complaint?
They amended the complaint in October of 2007, I believe.
Oh, so that's almost 3 years?
Yeah.
So, now, you said in your briefly in passing that the class is different?
Well, because of the non-overlapping time periods, that the claims handling companies are what define the class. It's not the underwriting companies that define the class. What they're interested in is the mechanisms used to adjust these claims. And the claims handling companies use different software, not perfectly overlapping software, and also not perfectly overlapping time periods. So claims that were filed by patients in the 90s, for instance, would not be claims that would have been adjusted by AIGM at all. And claims that were filed by patients in 2004 would not have been adjusted by AIGCS. So the record was very clear. They had all the opportunity to sue the right defendant at the right time. And on the relation back cases, what they're essentially asking for is to write the mistake component of relation back out of the rule. They keep talking about notice and prejudice, but that's a separate requirement. When you're adding or substituting a defendant, the mistake requirement is a special requirement for those circumstances. And all of the cases that deal with this kind of factual situation have come out the same way. When the purpose of this relation back rule is to deal with the situation where a plaintiff was mistaken about who to sue and learned the proper defendant to sue after the time deadline passed. That's not this case, because in this case, they knew before the time deadline passed. In every case we can find, and they have no case coming out the other way, but every case we can find that fits that pattern, where you have time to amend your complaint to sue the right defendant before the deadline passes. Powers in the 11th Circuit, Shea in the 8th Circuit, we talk about Kilkenny from the 9th Circuit at length in the brief,
if district court cases like Harris and Upshaw and Potts, they all come out the same way.
Is that because the statute of limitations was told in the other case, that they have no time problem?
Well, we don't. We're not taking a position on whether they have a time problem or not. When this case, if this case proceeds forward, they may have statute of limitations problems in this case as well.
Are you saying if they had promptly amended in November 2004, then they wouldn't have had a time problem?
That we wouldn't be able to assert a statute of limitations defense at that point?
Well, because I thought you were saying that. You had brought in the statute of limitations, so I wonder how it bears on this case.
Well, right now the statute of limitations, strictly speaking, is not at issue because all we have is the jurisdictional question. If there's no relation back as to AIGM, then there may be statute of limitations issues with respect to some of the claims asserted in this case.
You're saying that somehow. Relation back did not apply because any mistake they made would not have caused them a statute of limitations problem.
That's certainly an argument I think that would be available. That's what the cases have said, essentially, is when you have a situation where I'm likening the CAFA effective date to the time deadline in statute of limitations cases. It seems to me if you're going to incorporate relation back law, it should operate the way relation back law operates. The relevant time deadline in a typical relation back case is the statute of limitations. Here, the relevant deadline is CAFA's effective date. And so we're treating that deadline as the same.
Oh, so what you're
CAFA's
saying
effective
is,
date is not the statute of limitations deadline in this case.
I understand what you're saying. You're saying that they could easily have amended the complaint before CAFA became effective.
And then we wouldn't be here. There'd be no issue. And when that circumstance prevails, all of the federal cases come out the same way. The Illinois cases under the old rule came out that way. Zincoris and Nui, we cite in the briefs, all reflect the same rule that when you knew before the deadline who to sue, you have to sue, otherwise you can't, and you can't get the benefit of relation back if you wait. And those cases are still, I think, instructive because, as the Illinois courts have said, the change in the rule was a change that had the effect of making it more, not less, difficult for plaintiffs to get the benefit of relation back. So essentially they're asking for a complete revolution in relation back law that they're not entitled to. So we think on that basis alone, the district court was correct to allow this case to proceed in federal court. We've obviously also presented the other argument with respect to the new defendant rule. Be happy to take any questions if you have any with respect to that, but otherwise I'll yield the remainder of my time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hoffman. Mr. Piper, how much time does he have? 2 minutes?
First of all, Your Honor, the mistake term both in the Illinois rule and in Rule 15 means mistake at the time of the initial filing. That's what...
What sense does that make? Because why isn't Mr. Hockman right that if you learn about the mistake before the deadline, before it would hurt you to have made this mistake, whether it's statute of limitations or the CAFA effective date, if before then you can correct it, then you have to, right? Because you're asking basically for a tolling rule. That's what relation back amounts to when you have a deadline situation. And, you know, for tolling, equitable tolling, you have to be equitable. You have to act diligently.
Well, that's not what the law is, and it shouldn't be the law, which is not to say that the delay is irrelevant. The judge could say, look, you took too long. Even though this relates back, I'm not going to let you, in the interests of justice, amend the complaint. Rule 15 has an interests of justice
but
standard.
If you file a suit after the statute of limitations is run, you can argue, you know, equitable tolling, due diligence would not have revealed the identity of the injurer, and so on. You can do that. That's really the same thing. You're saying you didn't discover really who your injurer was. It's irrelevant, really, that you sued the wrong person. you didn't discover who your injurer was until some date. Well, as soon as you discover that, you have to, if you want to protect your rights against a deadline, you have to sue then or amend the complaint in this case to add the right defendant, right? Why isn't that?
Well, because
the situation's asymmetrically.
Because that's not how the rule is written. The rule says that the key questions are, was the defendant prejudiced and did they have notice of what was going on? There's nothing.
So there's no diligence requirement in your view?
There is in two respects, Your Honor. One is that could go to the interests of justice as to whether the amendment should be permitted at all. The judge could say, even though you might relate back for statute of limitations purposes, I'm not going to let you wait until the eve of trial or whatever to amend the complaint and bring in a new defendant.
So if the state judge simply fails to require diligence under state law, we're bound. Is that your view?
No, it applies also in one other respect, which is, was the defendant prejudiced and did the delay lull the defendant into thinking they've made a decision, they're not going to sue me? And that didn't happen here. There was no lulling. They had no reason to think this was a strategic decision. In fact, as Mr. Hochman alluded to, Mr. Springman was not actually a member of the class that was pled in his original complaint.
Speaking of the class, surely people who were not in the original class, they can't get the benefit of this, can they? That is, how do you have a situation where you're not only adding a new defendant, you're adding new plaintiffs?
Well, no class has been certified, so it's putative at this point. But
well, shouldn't we say, you would have to redefine your class?
We did redefine the class in the new complaint.
So the new complaint has a different class?
In the following respect, that the name of the adjusting company has changed from what the old defendant was to what
the new
defendant.
There are going to be different people in the class, right?
Well, the classes would be different, but not in a way that's...
I don't understand. The new people who are coming in, so you have a new defendant, but you also have new, and they're not plaintiffs technically, but they have new claimants.
Well, that would really only be the case once the class is certified.
Well, the suit is nothing without certification, right?
Right.
You're not interested in this as an individual plaintiff suit.
It's not worth very much as an individual case, that's for sure.
Well, thank you very much, Piper and Mr. Hochman. And the case will be taken under advisement, and the court is going to have a very brief recess before we hear the rest of the cases.